on today's episode of Mentally Stronger. What about for somebody who maybe has a narcissist in their life, but maybe for one reason or another, it's not a relationship you're going to end. Maybe you like your job, but you suspect your coworker is a narcissist, or maybe it's a sibling and you want to maintain some kind of a relationship, or a parent. What do you do when they try to bait you into an argument, or they're saying it's everything is your fault and not theirs? Are there any ways to disarm the narcissistic person?
I think that one of the primary way, because again, what you just suggested, Amy, is that people can't leave these relationships. That's true more than half the time. Every single one of us have to maintain some of our narcissistic relationships, whether it's a sibling that's embedded, like you said, in a larger family system, colleague at a job we can't leave, even a spouse where you have minor children or financial dependencies that you thought I could end up causing more problems than I've already got now if I end up leaving this relationship. So there's many reasons people stay, and it's understandable, and it's not a fail. A lot of people say, well, it's my problem because I'm not leaving. The issue, if you don't want to keep getting into the mud, basically you want to heal even though you're sort of maintaining contact with this person, is number one, you got to see it clearly.
Welcome to Mentally Stronger, the show that will help you develop the mental strength you need to reach your greatest potential, no matter what life throws your way. I'm Amy Morin, psychotherapist, mental strength trainer, and an international best-selling author of 6 books on mental strength. Every Monday, I introduce you to a guest whose story and expertise can inspire you to think, feel, and do your best in life. And the fun part is, we record it all from a sailboat in the Florida Keys. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Do you ever suspect that somebody in your life is a narcissist? If you spend much time on social media these days, you might feel like everybody is a narcissist. That term is used broadly, but it's not always used correctly. There are narcissists out there, though, and spending time with one is a surefire way to feel like you lack mental strength. So I'm thrilled to have Dr. Romani on the show today to clear up misconceptions about narcissists. She's a psychologist who studies the impact that narcissism and high-conflict personality styles have on relationships and mental health. She's the author of several amazing books on narcissism, including her newest book, It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. Some of the things she talks about today are how to recognize a narcissist when you encounter one, how to respond to their unreasonable behavior, and how to manage your mental health when you have an ongoing relationship with one. So here's Dr. Romani on how to cope with a narcissist. Dr. Romani, thank you so much for being on Mentally Stronger.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Maybe one thing we can start with is, can you define what a narcissist is? I think in the mental health world these days, we talk so much about narcissism that it gets kind of confused. I hear everybody being called a narcissist these days, and it's different than narcissistic personality disorder. So can you explain that for us first?
Yeah. So a narcissist is a person, I guess, I prefer calling someone a narcissistic person, but all things being equal, yes, we'll use the shorthand of narcissist, is a person who has a narcissistic personality style, enough so that it's noticeable, right? So this is a person who consistently and in a sort of a pervasive way shows up with variable or low empathy, entitlement, grandiosity. They're very self-centered. We see a lot of arrogance. There's a need for admiration. There's a need for validation, and they're chronically seeking it. They envy other people, or they think people envy them. There's a real lack of capacity for intimacy. There is a selfishness, like I said, a self-centeredness. They are very superficial. There can be a vanity, a status seeking. And all of these patterns together can show up in relationships as things like manipulation, gaslighting, devaluing other people, minimizing what other people are going through, feeling inconvenienced by other people, shifting blame onto other people. And all of those things I listed, the entitlement and the grandiosity and the arrogance and the selfishness, they're all known to be sort of defensive maneuvers around a person who, at the core, a very unprocessed, unconscious, unaware core, is quite insecure, quite riddled with shame, so that anyone would ever treat them as though they're less than perfect kind of almost wobbles up that shame. And then you see these very angry reactions, either overt aggression or anger or passive aggression. The distinction to narcissistic personality disorder is more of sort of like a technical one, right? So when we talk about a person who has narcissistic personality disorder or NPD, this is somebody who has shown up in therapy or some form of mental health evaluation with exactly the patterns I'm talking about. And in general, either the person is endorsing that these are this conduct is causing problems for them, they rarely would connect those dots, or that it's these patterns are causing social and occupational impairment. Here's where it gets tricky and problematic. More often than not, people with NPD have another clinical issue alongside it, whether it is addiction, depression, ADHD, anxiety issues. And with that other clinical issue alongside, it could even be things like what we call an impulse control disorder, like a intermittent explosive disorder, which we call sort of rage or road rage or something like that. When there's another clinical issue that shows up alongside the narcissistic personality disorder, the clinician will often focus on that other clinical issue. So they'll focus on the depression, they'll focus on the addiction, they'll focus on the other thing, because that's often the thing that's causing the problems for that person. The personality stuff takes a minute to show up. As a result, the vast majority of people who have NPD are probably not diagnosed with it. Just because someone's diagnosed with NPD doesn't mean that they necessarily have more severe narcissism. There's plenty of people walking out in the world who are narcissistic who have never and never will see the inside of a therapist's office. So those people will never be diagnosed. So there's people walking around with NPD who might actually have milder symptomatology than the person who is sort of living next to you or who is your boss because they've never seen a clinician. So I think that all of those sort of fine nuances are a big part of this.
Yeah, I've never had anybody walk into my therapy office and say, hey, I think I'm battling narcissistic personality disorder, right? People come in and they might say, I've looked it up and I might have bipolar disorder. I think I have depression. People come in with all sorts of diagnoses. I'm yet to ever have anybody walk in and say, I think I am struggling with this. How long these days, if you were to talk to somebody who is a narcissist, falls somewhere on that spectrum, how many minutes would it probably take you to figure it out?
For me or any clinician?
For you.
Or
now, for that, me? Now that you've been, for you specifically, because this is what you've studied and talked so much about.
I have to be frank with you. I think I could figure it out in an intake. So let's say call it in an hour. Right. I mean, and I think it's because this is what I specialize in. Just like the person who specializes in ADHD is going to be able to pick up the more nuanced ADHD stuff, just as a person who works with OCD picks up the nuanced OCD stuff, people with eating disorders pick up the nuanced eating disorder stuff in an hour. And I think I could probably figure it out. But even that, I mean, I don't want to toot my horn that much. I might need a couple of cracks at bat, especially if the presenting clinical issue is quite severe. But I think I would probably, I mean, I think there is a sort of a persona a person shows up. I remember million years ago in graduate school, one of my more seasoned supervisors says, we diagnose syndromal mental disorders, what we used to call axis one, like depression, anxiety. We diagnose those from the head and we diagnose the personality disorders from our body. We feel these clients when they walk into the room.
That's a good way to put it. That's quite interesting. How about in your personal life? Can you spot somebody these days, whether it's your neighbor, your colleague, somebody like that? Does it take you very long to spot it then?
Not as long as it used to. I think that it is, you know, what it is, as I always say, is that they have this unique capacity to look at you and you feel like they're looking through you at some point that's behind your head. So there is a contemptuous dismissal. There is a disregard. There is an entitlement. There is like this rage that is just under the surface. And because my own history in life has been characterized by people like that who are narcissistic, and, you know, I have my own sort of internal response based on my history. We can't devalue that. And so I think now that I'm allowing myself to see it, when I experience it, now sometimes I have to be careful, because I have to be honest with you, Amy, the person who's entitled, maybe from privilege or wealth, I may sometimes mispin those people because they do come off as so supercilious, so superior, you know, so I'm so important. Somebody's carrying my bag. Someone's carrying my lunch. Where's my parking? Why am I not special? But I understand some of that is a byproduct of just absolute privilege and their feet not touching the ground for decades. If I get a little bit more time with them, I might be able to sort of cut to the core of whether they do have empathy. But I do think that sometimes wealth and privilege can mask as narcissism. And so that's the place I think I probably get it wrong the most.
And that's an interesting point. And it brings me to something you said earlier, that people usually seek help when something's causing problems in their lives. Somebody says, my anxiety is making it that I can't go to work. That's a problem. So they come to get help. One of the issues with people who are narcissists is they often get rewarded, right? They become the CEO. They're often doing quite well financially. They might be enjoying a lot of privileges in life, in part because of the way they treat other people, and it kind of works for them, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is the problem. I mean, this is where narcissism presents such a unique issue. Because frankly, there's people out there who are in relationships with addicts, right? And we're willing to say, as a mental, as a profession of mental health, and even in the public in general, it's difficult to be married to an alcoholic. It's difficult to be married to an addict. I got to tell you, it's equally difficult to be married to a narcissistic person. But the addict, for example, is often having more sort of social and occupational impairment. They may be struggling at work. They might have a DUI. The things that publicly are showing someone is struggling. And so we're able to connect those dots. But when somebody is married to the CEO, to the person who's getting their 27th award, to the person who's being called the pillar of the community, that person in that relationship feels like they're losing their mind. Because every time that narcissistic person turns around, someone's telling them how great they are. One more wonderful thing is happening to them. And yet the people closest to them, their kids, their partners or spouses, even the sort of the people who work for them, right, are saying like, no, this is actually really awful. And this person's treating us badly, but everyone else is saying they're great. So maybe this is a misperception on our side.
Ian, there's a chapter in your book where you talk about the death by a thousand cuts, where you talk about that, how it's those little things that over time break us down, but it takes a long time to see. And that's why your book is titled It's Not You, because so often when you're in a relationship with a narcissist or you have one that's really close to you in your life, even if it's not a romantic relationship, you start to wonder, like, what am I doing wrong? Am I losing my mind? Am I messing these things up? Like, oh, I messed up. I should have done things differently. And it really causes us to second guess ourselves, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think that you got to remember too, I mean, and we know this, like, it's not like relationships represent, it's almost like watching a tree grow, right? It's not as though you plant a seed for a tree and then in a couple of days you see a tree. In fact, it takes a very long time for that to even look like a sapling, and certainly a lifetime for it to look like a full-blown tree. Well, I think that what happens in relationships is that as we meet someone, we trust someone, we grow to love someone, we experience a sense of attachment with someone, we also learn to make excuses for those people, because that's what maintains the attachment. Much of that is in the realm of empathy. They had a bad day. They learn to behave like this from watching an abusive father. They have a high pressure job. We come up with narratives that allow us to maintain the relationships, but there's only so many times we can feel like we're dumb. We're told we're foolish or dumb, or our memories don't work, or we're being invalidated, or we're being told that's not that big a deal, or, oh my gosh, stop complaining. It's just a little, you know, you just have a little cold or something like that. And we're actually quite sick. There's only so long you can hear that. That's the death by a thousand cuts, where one day you're like, this doesn't feel good. And one day everyone in a narcissistic relationship wakes up and will say, I don't look forward to seeing them. Or they'll have that moment where they're like, I'm really glad they're out of town, or I'm so happy they're not coming to Thanksgiving this year. Like, there is an internal acknowledgement of, I don't like it when this person's around as much. And most people at that point feel guilt. They feel disloyal, but they acknowledge a reality of a situation. You know, they might even have a little giddy smile to themselves, like, woohoo, they're on a business trip for a week. This is going to be great. And it's not just that, like, oh, I get to eat pizza in bed for a night and then you miss your spouse the third day. These are people who are saying, I see a difference. And in fact, it's something I call the natural experiment. I do this with a lot of survivors, and they'll say that, you know, it's interesting. It did happen. There was a business trip, or they got sick and couldn't come to a holiday thing, or they didn't show up at a family wedding because they had something else to do that week, or they didn't come to the business conference because they had a conflict. And then they have to, and then I work with the client to acknowledge, how did it feel? And they'll say, oh my gosh, it was a categorically different experience without them there. Even if it's a system of 12 people, one narcissistic person being pulled out of that can result in something being so much different, so much less tense, so much more of you not on your back foot. And those natural experiments, the reality, as it were, of life pushing something and saying, look, because you couldn't construct that, right? You couldn't say, leave for 2 weeks and let me see how I feel. life happens, you get to feel it. And that's often, again, another penny drop moment where people say, I actually thrive when this person's not around.
And that's interesting, because if the person said, let's have 2 weeks apart and see how it goes, we know that the narcissistic person will do all sorts of manipulative things and from love bombing and gaslighting and random things to try to suck you back in. And it would be really hard to to be able to pay attention to your feelings during that time, right?
Absolutely. And I think that, it, again, that's why the natural experiment is so great, because it's just sort of often happenstance, right? It spontaneously happens. If you were to suggest something like a break, break up, change in direction with a narcissistic person, they will either rage, manipulate, who do you think you are? Or you think you deserve better. You think there's better out there. You're going to be alone forever. Narcissistic people do not like being left for a couple of reasons. Some have attachment wounds, and these are experiences, significant abandonments, and sort of really activate sort of that anxious attachment stuff. In some cases, it's that they've simply lost control of the narrative. Like, if anyone's leaving, it ain't going to be you, basically. And so as a result, what would happen is if somebody made a suggestion, let's take a break, let's make a change, maybe let's go two different directions. In some cases, it's not unusual to see post-separation abuse, which can be on a continuum from stalking and threats and malevolence to smear campaigns, to guilt, to constant text messages. And that's so uncomfortable that you're basically choosing between two discomforts at that point. Do I deal with their vindictiveness and revenge, or do I just stay in the relationship? At least that's the devil I know. So these aren't very appealing choices.
Correct. What's your take on how narcissistic people feel about themselves? I mean, the classic idea of the narcissist is somebody that loves themselves so much, versus do you feel like they struggle with super low self-esteem? Are they actually suffering, or they just think everybody around them is stupid and doesn't do what they want to do and they're angry at other people?
It depends on the day, right? So when narcissistic people are incredibly unstable for that reason, and this is why their moods can shift so much in one day, they can wake up happy because they got good news about work. Then by 11, the world has ended and they're raging at everyone because that thing that was supposed to work out that day ended up, the deal didn't go through. They're very responsive to what is happening around them. Very, very responsive. And so very, I should say, very reactive to what's happening around them. But how do they feel about themselves? A lot of research has shown that narcissistic people have very distorted they have distorted self-esteem. They have distorted conceptions of themselves. So many of them, actually, especially grandiose narcissistic folks and communal narcissistic folks, they genuinely think of themselves as the most generous, empathic, wonderful people. They believe that. I mean, to the point where it feels delusional, because in the same breath, they could be cruel to someone. But they're for many of them, they're at least the self-concept they're sharing with the world. And the sort of the challenge is that, again, at this deep, unprocessed, unconscious level is a tremendous volcano of self-loathing, fear of being found out, shame, a sense of being imperfect. All of that's there, but they're not in touch with that. So they actually walk around, and I don't know, I mean, as a shrink, I suppose you go in there deep and you could get to that stuff. It's not easy. But what we have to remember is that narcissism, and this is where the work in the last at least 30, 35 years, 40 years on the vulnerable versus the grandiose narcissist has made all the difference in the world. Traditionally, the grandiose narcissist, the arrogant, preening, pretentious, look at me, I'm so great, aren't I smart, monopolizing the conversation, but also charming, charismatic narcissist has been our template, right? That's what we view. Mm-hmm. And in fact, these grandiose narcissists, they can be ridiculous and annoying, but not everything is bad with them. Like in some ways they actually do, they can keep some things in their lives, quite a few things in their life afloat. The problem is when things don't go the way the grandiose narcissist wants, that's when that vulnerable underbelly shows up. And here's where we see sullenness, victimization, resentfulness, passive aggression, grievances, the world is out to get me. You often even really see social withdrawal, social anxiety, this very grudging rumination. That underbelly, every narcissistic person has it. Now, for some grandiose narcissists, they're so well supplied and so well structured. They have money. They have people around them who do things for them. They have a good supply system around them. In essence, they're getting all the validation, admiration, and juice they want out of life. whatever that vulnerable underbelly is, it might show up at times, like when they have snappy rage, the deal didn't go they want, they find out something, they feel like a friend betrayed them or something. You'll see it out in flashes, but by and large, they're protected. And there's some people out there who are all vulnerable all the time. And those people actually do report lower self-esteem. The vulnerable narcissist will say, life didn't go the way I wanted, but it's not so much I'm no good. It's more of I could have been so much more if people just supported me. It's everyone else's fault for not cheering them on and being their champion. So that's their sort of journey. And so this is why the whole self-esteem picture with narcissism is very confusing. We think they have high self-esteem, but it's basically better to think of it as inaccurate self-esteem or inaccurate self-appraisal, because they don't see themselves clearly. They have no sense of how they affect other people, but they do think of themselves by and large as being either great people, competent people, capable people, and they toot that around. So all the rest of us are walking around with our neurotic wounds, like, oh, I don't really know that. Oh, I'm not good at that. We're all doing that. And when somebody walks in saying, I got this all figured out, I've been doing this for years, I know how to do this, we believe them. And we think they have it all together, not recognizing that humility is actually a real indicator of a healthier personality.
Let's take a second to get a quick word from our sponsors. Want a fun way to grow with your partner? Try an app called Paired. You and your partner download the app and pair together every day. Paired gives you questions, quizzes, and games to play. These activities can help you stay connected while also deepening your conversations. It's simple. Every day you get a quiz or a question to answer, and you can't see your partner's answer until you answer for yourself. Questions include things like, what do you remember about the first time we met? And what's something you admire most about your partner? Whether you're just a few dates in or have been together a long time, it's time to lighten the mood and have fun with your partner by using Paired. Head to paired.com/stronger to get a 7-day free trial and 25% off if you sign up for a subscription. Just head to paired.com/stronger to sign up today. Connect with your partner every day using Paired. A happier relationship starts here. Brainstorm. What's something that works so well that it's basically magic? Air conditioning? Noise-canceling headphones? Meeting-free Fridays? What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the did we just hit $1 million stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/mentallystronger, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/mentallystronger now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/mentallystronger. Okay, we're back. Which goes back to why they often get promoted at work, right?
Correct.
They walk in saying, oh, I can absolutely do this job, not a problem. And I believe there's research that shows that narcissistic people sometimes thrive in a times of crisis, especially because they sound so believable, like, oh, I have a plan for this.
Yeah.
We're going to get through
it. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And it's convincing. I mean, I think that because so many people have had confidence sort of socialized out of them, right? Whether it's how they were parented, whether it's how they went through school. We live in such a world of metrics, metrics, metrics. Did you go to the best university? Did you get the best grades? Are you on the top soccer team? Did you have this many followers on your social media? Whatever it is, we're so metric oriented. Nobody can keep up. We look at how together everyone else's lives seem. Most people are struggling with a sense of confidence. And because most people are sort of self-aware and aware of how they show up. I mean, again, we do have, I think in all cultures, there's a bit of tall poppy syndrome, but you know, it is a sense of, well, if I brag too much, that's not a good look either. For the narcissistic person, they're very comfortable with that. And we've made this assumption that if you're so vocal about what you're great at, almost like trash talking in sports kind of thing, then you must be really, really good. Now, obviously, a lot of this is gendered and all of that. I get that. But ultimately, we believe their hype. And at one level, it's almost like really looking, you know, the person says they can do it. You really want to look at their track record. More than anything, what the narcissists are not good at, they're not good under stress. Because the stress shows them that they're human, that things aren't going perfectly, that there are going to be frustrations. They don't like disappointment. And in fact, that's probably one of the best ways to get at the core of narcissism. How does this person respond when things aren't going the way they want?
Right. Then their human vulnerabilities become much more apparent, at least to those around them. Do they realize it? Do they have any insight into that?
Tiny bits. You know, it's funny. I once worked with a narcissistic client a long time ago. We did some good work together, but I mean, we moved the needle millimeters. And I've actually mercifully had other clinicians who I had releases to communicate with. And they said that you moved this needle a millimeter is nothing short of a clinical miracle. So they said, really, we do not know how you got through to this client. They were all very frustrated with this person. And so the issue then becomes this particular client started to recognize that he would always want to be in relationships with women who were sort of inappropriately young for him and very much on the make for his resources and money and power and stuff. But then he would often be on his back foot in these relationships because they wouldn't be everything he wanted. He basically wanted them to be like robots who would respond the way he wanted to everything, and he didn't want to be frustrated by them. But they would. They're human beings, right? And he would rage at them, scream at the top of his lungs, and they would get frightened or upset or hurt or all the things we would do if you were raged at. And one day, years after we stopped working together, but it's like, oh, I need a reality check. He's like, I know I'm not doing the right thing. I keep yelling at her and I know that's not okay. And I actually thought, woohoo, progress. He does keep yelling at her, not so much progress, but the awareness that it's not okay to keep yelling at someone and they won't like it. I was like, let's put that one in the win column. And I said, it's great that you're aware of that. But again, the problem with a lot of narcissistic folks in therapy is they want the magic pill. They're like, isn't there some new technique? Isn't there some new psychedelic drug I could take that's going to make it all go away? I said, sweetie, if that pill existed, I got to tell you, I'd be out of a job. So right. It's not a thing. And I think that the want for a quick fix is such a narcissistic want. As we talk more about this, I think more people who are blowing up their lives, their own narcissism, are becoming aware of it. In fact, narcissistic people are often incredibly intelligent. The two, narcissism and intellect, are correlated. And so they're aware that this is a pattern. They're aware it might even be a problem, but they also want it to go away quickly. And they little do they know that they have to plumb the depths of their souls and their insecurity, which is not a pretty journey. And that's the problem.
So there is hope that somebody who is a narcissistic person in your life may make some changes, small. And it's not a huge, I guess, not something we should hold on to, that this person is going to change.
No, absolutely not. And I think the problem is that I think when we have the change conversation, it sort of starts becoming sort of a bit of navel gazing and sort of an intellectual conversation. Because, you know, when we're talking about mental health, especially when we're talking about research in mental health and therapy, what qualifies as a statistically significant change that would get published in a paper that gets all kinds of notoriety does not necessarily translate into any kind of observable meaningful change in the life of a spouse, in the life of a partner, in the life of a child, in the life of a colleague, meaning that there might be this tiny little move and it might be an internal change. Their self-concept may have shifted, but they still haven't done the work on these reactive kinds of tantrums and all of that. So when I work with folks, I said, listen, we don't have good measures of interior change. The best we've got is the behavior, and the behavior is what's hurting you. Their manipulation of you, their invalidation of you, their gaslighting, their dismissiveness, their lying, their betrayal, their shifting blame on you, that's what's hurting you. That's what's affecting you. That's what's making this relationship seemingly impossible. So this idea of change then becomes tricky, because I think research can show some change, but it's often not always enough for a partner. It doesn't always go back, or a family member. It doesn't go always translate into making amends, right? Sometimes there's too much water under the bridge. And what gets really interesting for narcissistic folks is they'll say, well, I went to therapy and I'm not yelling as much. And they have a hard time recognizing that sometimes the wounds that were created in the other person are insurmountable. They're like, well, I've done the right thing. Almost like a kid. Well, I did the thing I was supposed to do. So why don't I get my allowance? Like, I did the thing. And they don't understand how sort of the anatomy of a human heart and how it's sometimes that there's just no going back. And that happens sometimes too. But whatever the changes are, because so much of what causes problems in narcissistic relationships is the reactive rage, is their tendency to personalize everything, is their sort of need for power, domination, and control, we rarely see that much progress there. And so those dynamics are what cause all the tension. And that's probably the hardest part to fix. I've worked with narcissistic clients in therapy who actually ultimately do connect the dots. They see how childhood issues show up in their adult personality. They do see how their adult personality causes problems. However, when the rubber meets the road and the argument comes up with the partner, they go right back to their dirty fighting tactics as though they're someone who is literally like, that's the only way they know how to fight. The difference is afterwards, they'll know they didn't do the right thing. And even if the apologies are a little bit more on point, the partner's like, to hell with this. I can't do this anymore. And you've now been in therapy for how many years? So it really depends on the relationship a person's in, but I don't know that the changes that a narcissistic person can undergo in therapy would ever be enough to create a relationship of empathy and depth of intimacy.
That makes sense. And if you've been in a relationship with somebody for years and there's been a lot of damage and hurt that lives on, it would be very hard to then erase that. And we know that change doesn't come in a straight line. Slowly. They take two steps forward, one step back. What about for somebody who maybe has a narcissist in their life, but maybe for one reason or another, it's not a relationship you're going to end. Maybe you like your job, but you suspect your coworker is a narcissist, or maybe it's a sibling and you want to maintain some kind of a relationship, or a parent. What do you do when they try to bait you into an argument, or they're saying it's everything is your fault and not theirs? Are there any ways to disarm the narcissistic person?
I think that one of the primary way, because again, what you just suggested, Amy, is that people can't leave these relationships. That's true more than half the time. Every single one of us have to maintain some of our narcissistic relationships, whether it's a sibling that's embedded, like you said, in a larger family system, colleague at a job we can't leave, even a spouse where you have minor children or financial dependencies that you thought I could end up causing more problems than I've already got now if I end up leaving this relationship. So there's many reasons people stay, and it's understandable and it's not a fail. A lot of people say, well, it's my problem because I'm not leaving. The issue, if you don't want to keep getting into the mud, basically you want to heal even though you're sort of maintaining contact with this person, is number one, you got to see it clearly that this is not the day it's going to change. If you truly radically accept in a narcissistic relationship, accept it's not going to change, that these behaviors are going to be constant, then you'll never be surprised again. When clients come back to me surprised, I'm like, no. We're surprised. You're 96% of the way there to radical acceptance. We need 100. When you are radically accepted, you're not surprised. You may be disappointed. You may be sad. You may be hurt, frustrated, and a whole long line of other emotions. Surprised means you're not there. We want to eliminate some of that surprise. The second is I often use this acronym when I'm working with folks is don't go deep. And by that, I mean, don't defend, don't explain, don't engage, and don't personalize. Just don't get into it with them. If they're telling you something you know is not true, you started it, and you know you didn't. It's at that point, it's ego for us trying to make the point we didn't. I have had clients who will literally say, we don't even need to talk in this session. I'm going to have you look at these text messages. And no lie, I'll spend the first 20 minutes of the session going through dozens of text messages and making notes. Honestly, for this client, they'll say, I need to be validated. Am I insane? I said, no, absolutely not. Like, this is what I see what's happening here. And they'll wait for my response. And they'll say, thank you. That's it. I am now whole again. Thank you. So sometimes it's just that audience who can say no, or they'll play a voicemail for me. And I'll say, ooh, and I'll hear it. And so it's the fully seeing it, not engaging with it, trying to understand what it is in ourselves. Like, listen, there's a normal urge to want to defend ourselves if somebody's misperceiving us. But you have to view that as energy. You're putting energy in trying to communicate with someone who's not listening to you. It's like you're speaking a language to them you don't understand. So if somebody started speaking, I don't know, Mandarin to me, and they just started speaking Mandarin louder, I don't know Mandarin. I'm still not going to understand it, no matter how loudly they say it. It's similar in a narcissistic relationship. No matter how clearly you defend or explain, they're not listening. They only know they're winning. And they're going to do whatever dirty tactic they need. It's almost like they're going to pull out loaded dice to win this game. So you can't win. So don't try. And so when you know that about them and they start doing this, you don't engage. You just sort of say, okay. And you say things like, I think we're having different experiences of this. But okay, now here's the warning bell on that. When you disengage, when you don't take the bait, when you don't get into the mud with them, they are not going to let it go that easily. The conflict, the argument is where they dominate and where they get a lot of supply from that domination. So if you don't give them that opportunity, they might actually get quite angry, dismissive, contemptuous, and insulting, saying things like, oh, did someone talk to their therapist today? Is that what you learned from your therapist? And so it'll be very, you know, mocking, and they just keep getting in there. And we're human beings. And there's a point at which if they push too much, we may ourselves have a strong reaction because we also have a threshold. And let me tell you, that's the moment they'll pull out their phone and start recording you. So that's what they'll show people and say, do you see what I have to deal with? So you almost are sort of training yourself into this sort of Zen indifference. But sadly, that is what you're training yourself into, is indifference. But you can get there.
Right. But it's, as you say, it's tough to do. When somebody says, hey, it's your fault I was late for work today, and here's why. And you're like, wait, what? No, it's not. Yep. It's our natural tendency to explain. We think they must see it differently. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to educate them, or I'm going to help them see that here's why I did this behavior. So I love that idea of saying, you know, no need to explain, and just don't engage with them.
Absolutely. Because what happens then is that we, from a very, very healthy part of ourselves, we view the relationship as reciprocal, as I'm saying something, you're saying something. Each one of us is building on the thing. If you say, if a healthy person was late to work, right? Even if they had a moment, they actually, the reason, part of the reason they were late to work was you didn't put the keys right in the right place, right? And they might even say to you, oh, you got to put the keys there because I know I cut it too tight in the morning, but can we get into a habit of always putting the keys in the right place, right? And if you indeed did put the keys in the wrong place, you'd be like, I am so sorry. And you would genuinely apologize. And they'd say, thank you. I hear you. I appreciate it. I had a tough day. And the two people are having this dance, right? That conversation could feel a little blamey, right? But ultimately, one person did not return the keys. The other one probably waited till the last minute. And we find that middle ground. Hell no, in a narcissistic relationship. And so that sort of knowing what it is means that we do not engage with it. Again, we don't speak loudly in a language that the other person doesn't understand, basically. And it is really it's a powerful pulling out of psychological energy, because a lot of times in these relationships, we're sort of whirling our arms and bodies all over the place trying to be heard, and that exhausts us. And so it's less exhausting. But like I said, you have to be able to weather what I'm going to call that initial ramp up, because you're not getting into it. In essence, they like it when you're dysregulated, because then you look unhinged. And when you look unhinged, right, they feel like they're the ones in control. So the less you're unhinged, the more you stay on point, even though you're like just so incensed that this person isn't seeing your point of view. This isn't that you're signing off on it. It doesn't mean you're capitulating to it. It doesn't mean you're agreeing to it. In fact, it's the rather grief-stricken realization that this is not healthy. And many times the arguments, Amy, are where people can kind of keep getting into that toxic back and forth. And by doing that, it actually stops us from seeing how empty these relationships are.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because disengage, decide, all right, you can believe that. I'm not going to waste my energy trying to convince you otherwise. It helps us realize that our relationship is not perhaps where we thought it was. Right. It's not worth the time and energy. We're going to put our energy into ourselves and not worry about changing their minds.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because I think that as long as we're engaging with them as though they're listening to us, we're sort of participating in a delusion. And if we're participating in a delusion, we're actually not seeing the truth of it. The day we stop engaging, and then the day we realize like, oh, I don't exist as a human being in this relationship, because you start playing it out like a chess game. If I move this piece, then this. If I move that piece, then that. If I were to get into it with them, they're going to gaslight me and tell me I'm a liar and tell me there's something wrong with me or blame me. If I don't get into it with them, then I'm sort of living in this uncomfortable position of not having my reality acknowledged, and they're raging at me because I'm not getting it into them, into it with them. But you're basically lifting the lid. And so when you're no longer participating in it, you have to see it clearly. That's the only way you can not participate in it. And that moment of not seeing it clearly can fill a person with absolute grief of, I've been in an inane marriage for 20 years. I've been in an inane relationship with this parent for my whole life. I am in a hollow relationship with my sibling, with my friend, whomever. So when we disengage from the toxic dance, there's a risk to that. And it's not a bad risk, but it hurts. And because we don't want to see it, we keep engaging.
And that kind of goes back to your point before of not expecting the person to change. Mm-hmm. If this is who your mother has been for 40 years, mm-hmm. she's probably not going to show up for you tomorrow and in a different space. This is what it's going to be.
And Amy, keep in mind too, that it's not as though someone's listening to this episode or has listened to any of this content on narcissism and hasn't tried to work this out with these people 1,000 times
right.
up till now. They have tried to do it gently. They've tried to do it by text message. They've tried to do it by email. They've tried to talk to them on a good day. They've tried to talk to them on a bad day. They tried to talk to them by phone. The people in these relationships have tried everything. They have shared their feelings. They have cried their hearts out. And every single time they have been met with resistance, denial, defensiveness, blame shifting, and contempt. So the day you are able to do what I'm suggesting now, this isn't coming on the heels of you have a great relationship and one day you have an argument and you're doing this. This is people who have been living this for lifetimes in some cases. And so it's the will, the day you see it clearly, is the day you realize not only is it gone, that it probably was never there in the first place. And that's like a living death. And that most people don't want to sign up for that. But the alternative is probably worse, because you are absolutely losing the essence of yourself by being in this relationship. It's a tough one. So then people will sometimes recognize like, okay, I can manage my father is bearable for 45 minutes. For 45 minutes, we'll actually be able to talk about the sports team we both love. And then the conversation goes someplace toxic. And I think that one, and I've known people to do everything to from set timers to have visits in a very sort of, constricted way, to go to the theater with people. So that limits the amount of conversation, but there's still the sort of time served in the sense of, okay, I'm in something, but with that awareness that this can't be what I wanted. It will never be a place of depth. It will never be a place of sharing. Most people are not ready to walk away from their parents. But seeing the limits in the relationship, again, the first reaction is grief. But then there's the possibility for realistic workarounds that are built on how this is actually going to go down. And some people say, I'm not doing this. This is a waste. I was doing this because I thought it could get better. If it's not going to get better, I want out. And then that's a different decision. I mean, all of these decisions are choices people have. People have to figure out what works for them.
Let's take a second to get a quick word from our sponsors. Okay, we're back. Yeah, because I've seen some people who say, you know, I had hoped that my parent would be an okay grandparent. I've come to that conclusion. They're never going to be a wonderful grandparent to my kids. So they do just that. I'm going to set some limits. I'll see them occasionally. We'll go to the family holiday party, but that's about it.
Right.
And I had to come to that place of acceptance that we're never going to have the wonderful family that I once dreamed about. And for some people that works. And for other people, it's more about saying, I'm probably just going to cut this person out of my life altogether and move forward. Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've given us some hope, though, some strategies that can work and some ideas of what to do to take care of yourself, because it's just so draining to be in a relationship with somebody like this. And when you spend years wondering what you're doing wrong, am I not communicating well enough? Am I not managing my own emotions well enough? What could I be doing differently to fix things? By the time people often come into my therapy office, they're exhausted by it.
They're exhausted, but I think, and here's the, absolutely, exhaustion, they're depleted is another word I would use. The issue though becomes is that I think that what's happened is that the hope is housed in the wrong place, right? The hope has always been that this is going to change. Once they retire, it's going to be better. Once the kids are out of the house, this is going to be better. Mm-hmm. Once they make partner, this is going to get better. Once we downsize, it's going to get better. Once we upsize, it's going to get better. It's always linked, and we call this future faking when the narcissist does it, but we future fake ourselves too. We're like, once this future thing happens, then, and it gives us some, it gives us an acceptable rationale to remain in it, because disrupting the status quo is its own sort of threat to our sense of safety in the world too. That also feels uncomfortable. So I think that if we can sort of take that hope, you just said, you've just given us some hope. We need to put that hope into ourselves, for I can actually start taking myself back. I can excavate my true self. I don't have to keep getting into these dehumanizing conversations on the daily, because that's what they're going to be with this person. And yes, that hurts. And yes, I'll get to the other side. And listening to conversations like this and other places, that you're not alone, because many people feel deeply isolated in this. Like, am I the only person who is in this kind of a mess? And is there something wrong with me? And now again, this is where the public conversation on this has changed the game. No, it's millions and millions and millions of people. But for the longest time, people suffered in silence because there was no way to have this conversation. So that exhaustion, that depletion, and frankly, I think a loss of a sense of self, because the only way the relationship works is if the person keeps appeasing the narcissistic person, giving in to them, reassuring them, like, all, it's a one-way street. Everything goes to their management and maintenance, and nothing is coming back at you. That kind of reversal is unsustainable. And so people, I'm going to be frank with you, it goes just about beyond exhaustion and depletion. People are getting physically ill in these relationships. Yeah. I am seeing people developing autoimmune or a real sort of flaring, significant flaring up of autoimmune, developing physiological conditions that don't line up with genetic risks, people who are experiencing all kinds of stress-related health issues that are debilitating, whether it's headaches, migraines, body aches, pick something. These are folks who are physically suffering, because your body is going to take this, because so many of us are like, I'm just going to keep going and keep a smile on my face. Well, guess what pays the price for that? Your body.
Yeah, I think there's been pressure for a long time for people to say, like, what can I do differently? And we talk about mental strength on this show. So people would be like, if I was just mentally stronger, I could hack this longer. And that is not the message we want for people to know. If you're in an unhealthy relationship, it will take a toll on you mentally and physically.
Absolutely. And I think that that idea, this is where I think some of the, this is where I do feel, frankly, the field of mental health has failed this particular client population, because it has always been, can you think differently about this? Can you change your point of view? Can you find a different way to communicate? I understand what we've always tried to do. We're trying to give the client a sense of efficacy or agency, that you're not just a passive recipient of this, but if you don't know what you're dealing with, you kind of are. And the field of mental health has often been quite reluctant to actually call this pattern out for what it is. It's always been the sense of, well, let's just stick to talking about you. Let's not concern yourself with your husband's narcissism. Like, let's just talk about you. No. Our clients are in a context, and this is the context and some fundamental psychoeducation. It's not meant to be blaming, like, your husband's a raging narcissist and you're great. But it's, if I were to tell you, and this is the way I've approached many clients. I've said, if I were to tell you the patterns in this relationship, these behaviors, we're really never going to change significantly. How is that going to impact your decision-making? Most clients look at me and say, Dr. Romney, give me a week on that one, because that is not what I expected. And then they'll go and sit with it. And some people will actually come back and they'll say, I'm out. Like, I'm not doing this. Some people will say, oh God, what am I going to do? And some people will think strategically, well, my youngest is 14. I think I can probably pull out another 2 years, and then, you know, they might have more say in where they stay or will affect them. Everyone's thinking very differently about this. And so it's giving people the realistic tools, because if we keep telling people, change your mindset to what? I mean, I don't even know what mindset would work here unless a person was well prepared, well taught, and well aware of the dynamics of this relationship, and that every time you blame yourself, that's exactly what they want. They blamed you, so you're blaming yourself, and it's not your responsibility. And the thing I keep bringing people back to is the conversation that comes up over and over again in narcissism is sometimes the narcissistic people have tough backstories, tough childhoods of their own, attachment issues of their own. They've gone through their own abuses. They've gone through their own traumas. They may have tough jobs, whatever it is they have. And people will get caught in like, I hear it. I get it. I don't want to be a bad person. I feel like I need to cut them slack. And I have to work with clients and say, good for you, loving the empathy, but let's focus on this behavior. I need you to get to the place where you understand what they're doing in this relationship is unacceptable, regardless of context. I'm thrilled you have the compassion to contextualize it, but I need to bring this down to brass tacks. This is not acceptable.
That's a great way to put it, because I think it is tempting to say, yeah, but they had a rough childhood, so therefore they don't know any better. But as long as we tolerate those things, we're mm-hmm. allowing it to happen to ourselves and sort mm-hmm. of figure out what's the plan? What are my strategies? What are my tools? And if I decide to end the relationship, that's one thing. If I don't, how do I at least set boundaries and disengage?
Absolutely. Because even boundaries are tough, right? Because I think that we often view as boundaries. I think, and this is where boundaries is such a fraught conversation when it comes to narcissistic relationships, that boundaries are something we often view as a communication. Like, I'm going to tell you how my standards, how I wish to be treated. And in a healthy relationship, you'll honor that. Never will that approach work in a narcissistic relationship. So I've seen all these folks who in their desperate desire to figure this out. I read this great book on boundaries and I watched this great video on boundaries. I'm going to go try that. And they get destroyed in the narcissistic relationship. And then what do? Well, it's my fault. I have bad boundaries. I don't know what I'm doing.
Right.
You don't have bad boundaries. You are trying to do the impossible here. I mean, it's basically, you know, you're trying to cut a tree with a butter knife. Like, it's never going to happen. And so I have always had to tell people, please put aside all that regular talk about boundaries. That's all great when you have two healthy people where it's just a lot of its calibration. When it comes to narcissism, the boundaries thing is entirely an inside game. You're not setting a boundary with them. You are setting a boundary within yourself on how you are going to engage with this person. And that's very different than how we usually have this boundary conversation. And I'm really actually frustrated at watching the harm that has come to people in narcissistic relationships who glom onto this boundary thing and say, well, this is just a boundary thing. No, it's not. They're not going to listen. They don't have empathy. They have nothing but contempt for you and they're entitled. So they think that they can set a boundary with you, but you can't set a boundary with them. Hypocrisy is a big part of these relationships. So the narcissistic person will often say, oh, that's my boundary. But if you try to set a boundary with a narcissistic person, you're selfish, you're entitled, you're greedy. They'll come up with a laundry list of terrible things you are. And if a person's already teetering, which they often are in these relationships, they'll believe that, especially if they grew up in a family of origin where boundaries were never a thing. They grew up with a lot of intrusiveness and really poor boundaries or histories of trauma. Those things all make this worse. So I do think that when it comes to the narcissistic relationship world, the boundaries conversation is very different than what the sort of conventional talk about boundaries is.
I think so too, because I think people have the assumption that you have to communicate a boundary. Mm-hmm. Hey, when you do this, I'm going to do this. What you talked about before is more like, no, I'm going to show you my boundary by not opening my mouth. I'm not going to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to announce, hey, we're not going to have this discussion. You just stop talking or you say, as you say, you see it one way, I see it this way. And then you don't engage, or it might be that you mm-hmm. you show your boundary with your feet, or you hang the phone up, or you don't mm-hmm. reply to the text message. But absolutely, I would say mm-hmm. in a relationship with a narcissist, announcing, this is my plan, and I'm going to do that from now on, they just up it and try to get you to try to violate your boundaries and see what your reactions are, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that that's the challenge is that you never, ever, ever, ever want to say to a narcissistic person, oh, you're narcissistic, and now I get it. So I'm not going to engage with you. This is your superpower is now that you know what the new ground game is, right? And you're going to keep that strategy to yourself. It's really a way of saying, I am no longer going to put myself into a dialogue with somebody who doesn't want to recognize that I'm a separate, subjective, existing human being in the world, separate from them. I'm not doing this anymore. This is an act of self-protection. I will, you know, whatever choices you've made about how you're going to maintain the relationship or not, you still don't need to give all of yourself into it, but you don't make announcements about this. When a person gaslights you, you don't say, oh, you're gaslighting me. You just hold on to your reality and you say things like, I think we're having different experiences here, or not my recollection, but okay. You know, either way, it has got to get figured out. And the knowing it, like I said, I'm not saying this makes it easy. I'm not saying it doesn't make it frustrating. You're going to have all those emotions, but that sense of you don't announce it to them. And the disengagement actually, frankly, Amy, has to be gradual. You can't one day say, oh, watch these videos, listen to Amy Morin's podcast. Now I got it. I am disengaging tomorrow. It's gradual. Right. You may not get like, so when they gaslight you at the dinner table that night, you might, you know, just sort of where you ordinarily would have gotten into an argument, you'd be like, okay, like I think that, you know, we're two different people. We had two different experiences and you're testing the waters. You may not sort of look for their approval. A hack I give everyone, talk about it on my YouTube, talk about it in my books, everything, is what I call the good, bad, indifferent approach. Is don't take your good news to them when it happens. When your good news happens, you take it to the good people in your life. Everyone's got one or two friends who are like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy for you. And you're happy for them. And it's lovely. And it's a beautiful moment to share with them, right? That could be your shrink, frankly. Go to people, don't go to social media first, because then the narcissist will see it too. And you want this to be a private experience. It could be you got good news at work or something. You got to hit a certain benchmark in your running training or whatever it is. Okay. Then the other thing you don't bring to the narcissist first is the bad news in your life. Whether it's a broken dishwasher or that you just got a terrible health diagnosis, go back to those good people again. Say, I just left to the doctor and this is what I was told. And the friend will say, you okay? And they'll sit with you with empathy and they'll listen to you. Narcissistic person, if they hear your good news, let's go back to the good news. When they hear your good news, they either are competitive, they minimize it. Well, it's not that big a deal. Or, you know, or something like, why do you need so much attention? Why do you need so much praise? Or they will make you feel foolish. They will make you feel bad about it. And as a result, it'll take away the joy of something you may have worked hard on or done or cared about. At least tell the good people first so you can have that moment of enjoyment. With the bad news, a narcissistic person is going to feel inconvenienced in many cases. Oh, what, now I'm supposed to feel something, or I'm supposed to help, and now you've made my day hard. So some people say that's not fair because now I'm having to manage all the problems in the household. I said, you've always managed all the problems in the household. The difference is you tricked yourself that you weren't, because you were taking the broken dishwasher problem to them like, oh my God, you're the one who picked that dishwasher. Blah, blah, blah. Now this is going to cost so much money. And you still end up being the person who calls the repair person. So it may be that if you have to consult with them on finances, you treat it as a fait accompli. Dishwasher's busted. I called the guy. It's going to be $300 versus this dishwasher's broken. What should we do? Just cut to the chase. They're going to yell either way. And if the bad news is really something terrible, I'm going to use medical as an example here because it comes up a lot. They're the last person you want to tell first. I'll tell you that now, because they'll view your medical condition as an inconvenience. Oh, what does this mean? Does this mean we have to cancel the vacation? Or like, I have a business trip coming up. Well, how does this work? Or, oh God, wait, isn't that place? We have the hospital like 30 minutes away. Who's driving you? It's all going to be, what do you expect of me? Or, oh my gosh. Listen, some people say, well, maybe they're saying that because they're scared. Then go get the damn help you need. This person is in a real moment of crisis, and we're having to babysit the narcissistic person's fragility. It happens all the time. And many people think the narcissistic person, listen, we've been married 25 years. At least they're going to show up when I'm sick. No, they're not. And many people thought this person would show up for them. And when the rubber met the road, they were scrambling. They're scrambling for rides to chemotherapy. They were scrambling for care after they got out of the hospital. They were scrambling for empathy. Plan on them letting you down. Do not take the bad news to them. Talk to the people who are going to listen to you, hold you while you cry, and slowly help you figure out the solutions. Make sure that the person who's driving you to difficult appointments uplifts you and doesn't make you feel guilty like, well, you know, this is going to make me 2 hours late to work. this is why I'm saying is knowing it makes you tactical. It's heartbreaking, it's devastating, and it fills you with grief, but you're already living in grief. Making it worse by having a person scream at you on the way to a chemo appointment makes absolutely no sense.
I couldn't agree more. I so appreciate that you've written this book, that you've started this conversation, you have a podcast, you're putting this information out into the world. For our listeners who want to learn more, we'll link to the book, and I hope everybody goes out and buys a copy of It's Not You. But where else can people find more about you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can find a big YouTube channel. We have new content every day, so go check that out. Odds are we've already answered your question. For people who want to do a deeper dive into healing, I have a monthly healing program that has workshops and Q&As and a wonderful community platform. So you can try it out for a month, see if it works for you, and come check that out. And so you can just go to my website to find that. I've written other books on this topic. You can check those too, but please order this new one because this one's really about healing. And so you can go to my website and find all of that as well. If you're a therapist listening to this, I've also developed a 36-hour online training program that leads to a certification in working with clients experiencing narcissistic abuse. So if this is a clinical population you're interested in working with, I would highly suggest you check out that training. It approaches it from many angles. We also have modules on trauma, on the legal and ethical issues of working with this client population. It's about time we had sort of systematic training models. And like I said, we'll give you a certification and help you feel better prepared to work with these clients. And we always have different things going on. And, you know, all of that will always be on our website. Follow me on all social at Dr. Romani as well.
We will link to all of that in our show notes, and I'm thrilled that you have something for therapists as well. Dr. Romani, thank you so much for being on Mentally Stronger.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Welcome to The Therapist Take. It's the part of the show where I'll break down Dr. Romani's strategies and share how you can apply them to your life. Here are three of my favorite strategies that she shared. 1, accept that the narcissist behavior will continue. It's tempting to think that somebody in our lives are going to change, even if they're a narcissist. Or we think that if we change our behavior, they'll definitely change theirs. But a narcissist's behavior isn't dependent on what you do. Even if you're really kind, they're still going to act out. Or even if you do what they ask, they're still going to do what they want to do. Accept that they're likely to repeat their behaviors over and over again, and don't expect them to act differently. 2, don't go deep. Dr. Romani uses the acronym DEEP to help you figure out how to respond to a narcissist. It stands for don't defend, don't explain, don't engage, and don't personalize. But our natural response is often to want to help somebody see something different. We think we can explain to them how they're playing a role in the issue, and they might have a light bulb moment and change their behavior. But that doesn't work with narcissists. So don't waste your energy trying to defend yourself or getting into a heated dispute. Instead, acknowledge you see things differently and move on. No need to justify why you see things differently, and don't try to explain anything because you aren't going to change their minds. And 3, establish boundaries. Create boundaries that are focused on changing your behavior, not trying to get the other person to change. That might mean you're not going to reply to text messages that are mean, or that you're going to hang up the phone if a narcissist calls you names or makes a threat. Remember, you get to decide how you want to respond to them. So those are 3 of Dr. Romani's tips that I highly recommend. Accept that the behavior is likely to continue. Don't go deep, and establish boundaries for how you respond. If you want to hear more of Dr. Romani's tips, check out her book, It's Not You. It's available wherever books are sold. Thank you for hanging out with me today and for listening to the Mentally Stronger podcast. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Apple or Spotify. It's one of the best ways to help us get our show in front of other people so we can make the world a stronger place. And if you know somebody who could benefit from learning more about mental strength, share this show with them. Simply sharing a link to this episode could help somebody feel better and grow stronger. If you want more tips on building mental strength, subscribe to Mentally Stronger Premium. You'll get weekly bonus episodes where I answer your questions, and you'll get lots of extra freebies too. Sign up at mentallystronger.supercast.com or just click on the link in the show notes. And as always, a big thank you to my show's producer, who's far too humble to ever be mistaken for a narcissist, Nick Valentine.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap, Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.